everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Fish Bites, the Miami Herald's Miami Marlins podcast. I'm Jordan McPherson, and joined by a good friend of mine, one of the regulars on the Marlins beat, Danny Alvarez from El Extrabase. Danny, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. J-Mac, thank you so much for having me again. I think it's been a while, but no better time to talk about Marlins baseball than right now, right? With 11 games over 500 and getting some key pieces back in the roster.
Yeah, and you mentioned it, so let's just jump into those key pieces. I mean, first off, we have Tebow, who, if you're seeing the video version of this, Danny just shows his dog Tebow, who I hear is a great soul, even though he likes to be a little disruptive.
Is that accurate? That's very accurate, yeah.
And speaking of good souls who like to be disruptive, especially on the base paths, Jazz Chisholm Jr., the Marlins are finally getting him back. He's been on the IL for about 6 weeks now with turf toe. Last played on May 13th when he collided into the wall in left center, trying to make an inning-ending play against the Reds. His toe collided with a metal portion of the bottom of the center field wall. It's been out for, like I said, about 6 weeks, but Marlins are about to get him back. And honestly, it's a huge addition back, considering the Marlins have had a winning record without him. But to be able to infuse him back into a lineup that you're seeing a lot of pieces click. And now if you're able to bring a dynamic player like Jazz back, if he's able to play the way that he knows he can play and the team hopes he can play, it just adds another key piece while the Marlins are hot.
Absolutely, Jordan. And I think Jazz is a game changer with everything he's capable of doing on the baseball field. Hitting, running, now with good defense, because that's one thing that we have to highlight here is that he was playing very, very good defense at center field. Obviously, we knew it wasn't going to be easy. First couple weeks of spring training were kind of tricky for him, but he was able to make the adjustment. Then when team broke camp and got to Miami, obviously adapting to a new outfield, especially center field in Miami, that is not easy at all, was going to be a challenge. And I think he got adapted pretty quickly. So that's something that we have to highlight. And yes, I think he's definitely going to make an impact in this team now that he's back. I think he finds the team in a very good position, of course. And we have to give credit to the guys who had that next man up mentality and were able to take a step forward. Obviously, the ones who came in trades like Jonathan Davis, who has been incredible for them offensively, surprisingly, and defensively too. So I think it's no better time to get him back than right now.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Jonathan Davis, because I wanted to give him a big shout out for what he's done this last month. I mean, Marlins trade for him midseason, about a week and a half after Jazz goes down with injury. And you really don't know what you're going to expect. I mean, he has big league experience. He had about 150, 160 games, but the numbers really didn't point toward a guy who was going to be an everyday contributor. And then those first two games in Colorado, three hit game. Offense was steady throughout, hitting about 270 a month into his time with the Marlins. The defense was great. And you got to give kudos to the front office for identifying him and the analyst group that was combing through guys to find and identifying that he could be a guy. And you also got to credit Jonathan Davis for being obviously what you saw on the field with the offense and the defense, but his personality just fit right into this clubhouse too. I mean, again, you just see another upbeat, positive vibe guy. He's basically like you may have lost Jazz on the field, but personality wise, you didn't have a drop off once you added Jonathan Davis to this lineup. And it just, again, it's one of those incredible stories, one of those stories that kind of goes under the radar with everything else that's gone on. And we're going to talk about a lot of those other key topics later on. But yeah, Jonathan Davis has been a really good addition. I'm interested to see what they end up doing with him moving forward now, because obviously if Jazz is there, you want him every day. You're going to want him in center field. Davis can play in the corners as well. If you want to give Dale Cruz or Jesus Sanchez days off, or just keep him in that pinch runner type situation as well. He has that versatility, he has those attributes that enable him to be useful even when he's not in the everyday lineup.
Yeah, I think he earned it. And I think that we're seeing that with the moves that the team made today. sending both Garrett Hampson and Jacob Amaya to AAA Jacksonville, because that was a topic of discussion. What were they going to do when Jazz was ready? And now that Jazz is ready, we know that he's going to be activated for this Boston series. And they kept Jonathan Davis. So, yeah, as you mentioned, he can play the corner outfields. I don't think that at this point the Mariners are going to platoon very much, Jazz, just like Mattingly did last year. But if that happens one day, maybe to give Jazz an off day, he can be a center fielder again, the center fielder against a lefty pitcher. So I think these are the tough but good problems that both managers and front office want to have. And he earned it. He definitely earned it. Same thing is happening with the rotation, for example. Yeah. Speaking of guys who stepped up with Brian Hoyne with back-to-back great starts. So, yeah, it's something that we really have to give them credit for.
Yeah, and you mentioned two of the moves, Amaya going down and Hamps going down. Gene Segura is also going to be back. The Marlins activated him. He's missed about a week with hamstring strain. John Birdie has been the main guy at third base. So now you have what? Now we also see how the Marlins handle the left side of the infield, because when Amaya was up, it was basically Wendell and Amaya able to platoon at short, and Birdie was every day at third. Now we'll see how they basically have that three-man rotation with Wendell, who's at shortstop, Segura at third, and then how Birdie gets used in between the two of those, and also the occasional spots in the outfield, because Birdie can just play wherever the heck he wants and knows how to show up. But to transition to the big picture of the team, we're 79 games in. Wednesday, assuming weather is cooperative over these next couple days, Wednesday will be game 81, the halfway mark of the season. As you mentioned at the top of the episode, 45 and 34 in so far this season heading into the Red Sox series. Third best record in the National League. Only the Braves and the Diamondbacks are ahead of them. Danny, to you, what stood out the most about this run so far through 79 games? What has impressed you the most, and just your thoughts on seeing what this team has done so far in year one under Skip Schumacher?
It's difficult to point to just one thing when a team is playing so well. But something that we definitely have to highlight is that this team has come back and win over 21, 22 times.
I think it's 22 after the Pirates walk-off. The Pirates walk-off made 22, I believe.
Exactly. So it's 22 times, and that just tells you about the resilience of this team and how resilient they are, and knowing that whether they're down 3-4 runs, they can come back at any point of the game. Something that we didn't see happening in years past, especially something that personally frustrated me for the last 2 years, was that they were playing close games. That's why they lost so many games by one run, but they just let games go away just in one inning by allowing 4 to 5 runs. This year, we've seen, for example, Sandy having an inning like that, allowing 4 or 5, and then coming back and winning that game, even though Sandy didn't have his best stuff that particular night or day. And that gets me to my second point: how good they've been this season, knowing that their ace, their Cy Young, has had the worst stretches ever experienced in the big league so far. And we know that a pitcher of his talent, his quality, and how much he works, that might be the best acquisition the Marlins may have for the next couple months, knowing that at some point Sandy will get back to be Sandy. So that's something that I've really liked about this team, their resiliency, and also how good young players, and especially in the rotations, guys like Eury Pérez, Edward Luzardo, has been able to fight and keep this team in the right now in wildcard positions, but really chasing the Braves.
Yeah, I mean, if I told you at the start of the season, through 15 starts, Sandy's ERA would be hovering around 5, and the Marlins would be 6-9 in his starts, and they'd be 11 games over 500, how crazy would you have called me?
I would have told you to please go and seek help. Like anonymous alcoholics or something.
Yeah.
Because it's like, what have you been drinking, man? I mean, it's something crazy, but yeah. And that's, I mean, obviously we know that how good Sandy can be, and I don't think that's might be a deep concern now, knowing especially how encouraged Skip Schumacher, not now series, sorry. Especially with how encouraged Skip Schumacher was on his last start or after his last start that he mentioned that was pretty encouraging. But of course, I mean, the team has done a pretty good job to actually give him room support and, yeah, and to know that, yes, I mean, we don't have to depend only on Sandy. And last year it got to a point where it seems like they only won every 5 days when Sandy was on the mound.
Yeah, and a couple of the other points I want to bring up. You brought up the close games, obviously the one-run game differential. For me, the bullpen. I mean, that's something that gets overshadowed a lot with this team. And you look at, again, just the acquisition they brought in, AJ Puck coming in and establishing himself as the closer right away, making it easier with Tanner Scott and Dylan Floro not having to rely on those two every single game. The emergence of a guy like Andrew Nardi, who the little bit we saw of him last year was not good. Just in the simplest, nicest way to say it. And he's become a guy who you can put him in whatever situation. He could be coming in with runners on base and you need him to hold them, to strand them. Or he can come into a high leverage situation, or you're going into extra innings and you've burned all your main guys. You still have faith that a guy like him is able to step in there. And then again, JT Chargois, Stephen Oker, Huascar Brazabaugh, I know he's had a rough stretch. His first 2 months were outstanding. Yeah. To be able to see just the improvement there. Because I know the offseason, priority one was getting bats and improving the lineup, and they have done that. Priority two, which was more, was very secondary, was beefing up that bullpen just in terms of the depth. So you didn't have to rely on players A, B, and C every single close game. And you got to give kudos to them for doing that. And also for the pitching staff, the coaches, Mel Stottmeyer Jr., Weldon Cepeda, for enhancing the talent that they have in that bullpen.
Yeah, great. I mean, great to mention Mel and Beef in this conversation, because they've obviously been key parts of building that. And also, we had that doubt during the offseason, not knowing for sure if they were coming back. Mm-hmm. And I think that for Skip Schumacher to build a whole new coaching staff, but to keep those two guys might be the key to the success of this team, because of what you just mentioned, the evolution of the bullpen arms. Nardi, as you mentioned, Brazo has never pitched so many games and innings like he's doing now in the big leagues. And yes, he's had a couple of rough stretches, but he's able to learn to, first of all, accept it and say, okay, I know I need to, where do I need to work on, and then move forward. So yeah, bullpen has been a big piece of this. I think though that they still have to manage something to give a little breather to those guys.
Of course,
obviously the break for the All-Star game will be huge for them, because yes, they've been pitching very well, but we know that we still have a second half ahead of us, and that's where things get a lot difficult. And yes, they have the talent, but it's going to be something new for many of them, you know, to be pitching close games and important games this time of the year.
Yep, no doubt about that. And now to move over to a few individual highlights, how can we not start with Luis Arraez? I mean, I think he just got a hit while I was talking here, just because it seems to be what he always does.
For sure. And John Jay just got hit on the chest again.
Yes, he did. Again, that dude has to be black and blue at this point. I'm very curious to see what he will look like once the regular season ends and how that continues. But with Arraez in general, going into the series, only hitting .399 on the season at this point.
Only.
I mean, the dude's just, he's slacking right now. I mean, but seriously,
what a
just
bummer.
I mean, I know you've been following him closely even before this. I know, because again, for those who don't know, Danny's website, Alex Chavase, looked at a lot in terms of the Latino players, but it's a very specific with Venezuela as well. But so with Luis Arraez, when the Marlins acquired him, I know we talked about it during the offseason when they were looking for players, and you were like, I wonder what would happen if this team ends up getting a Luis Arraez. And I don't know if we were just joking or just BSing with it. And then it happened.
It happened.
And now we saw what he did last year, batting title, .320-ish batting average throughout the year. But did you think that he could be a guy doing what he's doing now, hitting almost .400? I think he's only swung and missed 28 times this year. It's something like that. It's just
to be able, 1,000 pitches. Yeah.
Yeah. Just from your vantage point, what has it been like seeing him this year? And from the time you spent following him and watching him before, what's changed?
I think that the one thing that has changed, honestly, Jordan, has been him taking care of his body and getting in shape for the season. Because I remember watching him when I first saw him was probably 6 or 7 years ago in the Venezuelan Winter League. He was 19 years old, playing for Magallanes, Navegantes del Magallanes, which is one of the most important teams in Venezuela and the Caribbean, with a huge fan base, and playing games against Leones del Caracas, which is like a Red Sox and Yankees type of rivalry in Venezuela, where every game is packed with more than 20,000, 21,000 people in the stands. And this kid was playing those type of games like nothing. Like, it was a wiffle ball game for him in a backyard. So, of course, I'm not surprised that he can hit, because he's been always a great hitter at every single level, winter ball, single A, double A, triple A, whatever. But to be almost hitting 400 at this level, when we're seeing basically every single pitcher that steps on the mound throwing 95 plus with a nasty sinker, nasty slider, nasty changeup, basically every single pitch, and he makes it look so easy. It's something that I would have never imagined, and gotta give credit to him for how hard he's been working in games, before the games, post games, off season, in season, on his body balls. But also, this guy, for example, as we're talking right now, he's probably in Boston in his hotel room, having a video chat with his hitting coach, Frank Valdez, with a little tee and a little bat, and he's just swinging and just asking Frank, okay, what did I do wrong? Or is this good? Is this bad? Because that's how much he works. When he has time off, he usually calls Frank and asks him, like, hey, am I doing this good or bad? Even though he's hitting 400 or whatever.
You know, it's absolutely unreal. And also in this day and age where everything is home run, strikeout, basically, to see a guy who goes back to that old hit collecting mentality, the stuff we don't really see anymore, it makes you appreciate the skill set that much more because of just how different it is from the modern day. It gives you that old school throwback type deal.
Absolutely. And now we see so many people saying, oh yeah, he's hitting 399 or 400, but he's just getting singles. Well, if it was that easy, then everyone should be getting singles, right? But we also know that he can hit for power. We saw his homer this weekend. He can hit for extra bases. And when you see him top 5, top 6, top 10 in weighted runs created plus, WOBA, OPS plus, these new analytical stats that people pay attention to and value only by the sabermetric side of it, well, then he's pretty damn good, because he's on the top with guys like Acuña, guys like Soto, guys that are MVP type caliber players. And guess what? He's playing that type of baseball because he's that type of hitter. So I'm really, as a Venezuelan and as someone that is close with him, I'm very proud. Cannot say I'm fully surprised, but I have to say that every time he gets ahead with a pitch that is 4 inches off the plate and he drives it to the other way or line drive center field, I'm like, dude, this is the most incredible thing I've seen in a while on a baseball field.
Yeah, and in addition to what he does on field, just like we talked about with Jazz and John Davis, he's got a good personality too. He's that guy you just see walk around the clubhouse and just find whoever he wants and just starts up a conversation and just lightens the mood.
And doesn't matter if it's you, Christina, Di Nicola, whoever. I mean, he will do it. And I definitely think he's changed the culture of this clubhouse, because it's also contagious. You want to follow what it's good, right? And the guy is the best here in the game, probably. And he's, as you mentioned, a great personality in the clubhouse. And I think that's something that this team really needed. When we hear someone like Jazz saying, hey, I'm just going to be doing everything he's doing and follow everything he's following, you're like, dude, this is serious, because that's Jazz saying that. And then we know Jazz. So, yeah, he definitely changed it, and spot on Kimang in the front office. I think it was during the winter meetings when we said, what if
Yeah.
they get this kid?
That's right.
Obviously, we lost a great personality in Pablo, who we really love, we really like. But Luis has been a blessing for the city of Miami.
Yeah, and now to go from one of the top guys in the batter's box to probably the next great thing on the mound who's already establishing himself, like you mentioned earlier, Eury Pérez. Nine starts in, again, just to make sure I give the reminder like I give every time. This guy's 20 years old. He's nine starts into his career. All he's done is pitch to a 1.34 ERA over 47 innings. He's given up just one run over his last 33 innings. It's just, this game should not be this easy. And this 20-year-old, 6'8", 99-mile-an-hour throwing kid, and it still feels we're calling him a kid because he towers over me and he's so professional and so mature as a 20-year-old, just making this game look like it's child's play. And maybe it is fitting a call of child's play considering, again, he's 20.
Yeah, you gave me a hard time when I was 22, 23 for saying that I wasn't legally allowed to drink. But he's not legally allowed to drink yet. So if this team makes the playoffs, he has to get out of the clubhouse because he can't celebrate with champagne.
They'll have some sparkling cider for him. So make sure to have some cider for him.
Something for Eury. But yes, I mean, and you nailed it with the maturity of this guy. How he's been able to learn to grow up so fast. Obviously, being with guys like Sandy Alcantara for many years, being very close to him, not only for being Dominican, but also the same agency, working out together and all of that. But we have to give credit to Eury, his family, his parents, his coaches, and everything he's been working on to be at this level. And as you mentioned, so young, that also brings up a topic that has been for discussion for weeks now, is that, okay, when are we going to see? I mean, what are we going to see from Eury going forward? Because at some point, he's going to reach an innings limit. And what will the Marlins do with him? I mean, would they send him down? And it's a tough discussion because the guy, as you mentioned, has a 1.34 ERA. He might as well be not only rookie of the month, but pitcher of the month in the National League. But he clearly deserves it. And it's been something crazy for a 20-year-old guy. So he's making this front office and coaching staff scratch their heads because it's been really good. But as we know, he only has pitched 77 innings. That's his career high for any level. He's only 20. You have to, even though they need him to stay in this fight for the playoffs, you gotta also think ahead and know that he's 20 and he's gonna be a huge part of this organization going forward.
Yeah, no doubt. You mentioned the innings count. He's already matched his career total for a season after his last start. So every pitch he throws from here on out, we're in uncharted territory. Yeah. And I mean, I feel like probably 115 to 120 was probably what they were hoping for this year. And if that's the case, he has about 45 innings to play with. That's not a lot of wiggle room. And it probably, again, they're appreciative of the fact that he was able to get up here, get this extended taste, but it also happened because of the state of the rotation. Mm-hmm. They were without Johnny Cueto. They were without Trevor Rogers. They had Braxton Garrett fill in immediately for Johnny Cueto, and Braxton's been absolutely fantastic. I mean, if you remove that one game where he got shelled against the Braves, the 11-run game, he's hovering around 2.5 ERA on the season if you take that one outing away. And when Trevor went down, they started with Brian Hoeing, had him make two starts and then did a bullpen game. And then they finally said, you know what, this isn't working. Let's bring Eury up, see what he can do. But in a perfect world, he probably would not have come up as quickly as he did just because of the innings monitoring they wanted to do. So now it brings up the question, is 120 or something in that range going to be the cap? Or if they see that he's doing well, would they push it a little bit farther? And if so, how far would that go? And where does this either shut down or time where you skip starts, when would that begin? He has two starts left before the All-Star break. I would imagine you give him those two starts, 10 innings, 12 innings there, and then figure everything out in the second half. because especially with the state of the rotation at this point, you kind of need him for these two.
Yeah, because especially we don't see, sadly, we don't see those pitchers that went down coming anytime soon. Cueto, of course, he's the closest one because he's pitching games at Triple-A, but he hasn't been pitching that well. It's kind of concerning. Trevor, as you mentioned, has a tear in one of his lat muscles, so he's going to be out for a while, and that's a problem for them. I mean, a good problem to have on every side, but obviously it complicates things a little bit. So I think it's a right time for the All-Star break to come because they will need to they will need him to rest. And then, as you mentioned, figure what's coming next. It kind of reminds me of the situation with Jose Fernandez in 2013. Obviously, he came up because Sanabria went down, Nathan Eovaldi went down, Henderson Alvarez went down. So they had nobody else to fill in, and they had to use Jose. And Jose ended up throwing 170 something innings that year. But it's a different case. Maybe Jose has a stronger dude who pitched more in the big leagues. In the minor leagues, I meant, and it was a different type of pitcher, but the situation is kind of similar. And but the thing is that Jose wasn't pitching in those intense games that the Marlins are about to face now because that team was basically eliminated from contention since day one. For Eury, it's going to be a whole different world now.
Yeah, no doubt. And only have a couple minutes left here, but before we wrap the episode up. Wanted to give you a chance to talk about a topic that has been something you've been following and tracking for a while now, and it's fitting because he's going to be back down here next month. Miguel Cabrera, you got to cover 3,000 hits. You and Alex Chabase, you guys have been following his final season. Just give us the quick version of what this experience these last couple years have been like, being able to be as close with Miggy as you have been, and just the emotions of what these last couple months of his big league career are going to be like.
No, I appreciate you giving me time to speak about this, Jordan. It's one of my favorite topics, and it's been a privilege, an honor, a blessing to be this close to the greatest Venezuelan player of all time, one of the greatest Latin player of all times, and kind of emotional too because we're seeing just the last of him. But it's been a fun ride. Last year, as you know, we went to Detroit to cover the 3,000 hit, and he got it. All the celebrations and all of that, and now to have him back to Miami this year, his final season. The Marlins fans and Venezuelan fans in South Florida are a big community. Are going to have the chance to give him a very deserved and great farewell in his final season, and I think that's going to be pretty special for both Venezuelan and Marlins fans and baseball fans in general who live here in South Florida. I encourage all of you to go and to every single game that weekend, but especially Venezuelan Heritage. You're also going to be supporting a good Venezuelan cause down there. And yes, I think the only tricky part is that I don't know if I'm going to be missing that final game in Detroit because there's another Venezuelan guy in the Marlins that is making history with every single hit he gets. And he's going to be back-to-back batting champion, but in different leagues. And that has never happened before. So, yeah. Of course, that last part of the season, we're going to be obviously following Miggy, but Luis Arraez very closely. And I think that could be very special too, but it's because Miggy's kind of passing the torch to these young stars. You know, we see Acuña, but Luis, of course, is going to be part of that core of Venezuelan players that are now going to be the stars of this game.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's going to be fun to watch both of those as they track everything down to the very end. But with that, that's going to do it for this week's episode of Fish Bites. Danny, thank you so much for the time as always. Looking forward to catching up with you again once I'm back in Miami. And with that, we will see you all again next week.
100%. Thank you so much, Jordan.